Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza, an allied healthcare professional with over 25 years of experience. My career has primarily spanned private physical therapy and public school athletics. Driven by curiosity and a passion for the industry, I created the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast to explore the ever-evolving landscape of healthcare with a focus on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we'll dive into the challenges healthcare professionals encounter and discuss how collaboration can enhance understanding within the industry. Our goal is to improve the experience for patients and athletes alike. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. Chad Starkey. Chad is a professor and the chair of the Department of Athletic Training at Ohio University in Athens. Chad also serves as director of the School of Applied Health Sciences and Wellness and the School of Rehabilitation and Communication Services. A graduate of West Virginia University, he received his master's and doctoral degrees from Ohio University. He has served as a commissioner for the Commission on Accreditation of Athletic Training Education, on the board of directors for the Board of Certification, and as chair of the Education Council of the National Athletic Trainers Association. From 1986 through 2018, he provided epidemiological services to the NBA. He has authored several textbooks focusing on sports medicine, orthopedic diagnosis, and therapeutic modalities, and has served as a co-editor for four editions of Tabor's Cyclopedic Medical Dictionary. Now on to the show. Welcome everybody to this episode of Behind the Sports Medicine podcast. Today I have Dr. Chad Starkey, professor and the chair of Department of Athletic Training at Ohio University in Athens. Chad also serves as the director of School and Applied Health Sciences and Wellness and the School of Rehabilitation and Communicative Sciences. Dr. Starkey and I met each other. It's got to be almost 34 or 5 years ago when I was a freshman going into Northeastern University in the athletic training program, and Dr. Starkey was our program director. So I said, you know, who better than to reach out to Chad and talk about the profession of athletic training. So here we are. Chad, welcome.
Pleasure to be here.
Can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? I gave a little brief summary, but you know, how you got into athletic training and kind of where you are today in your career.
So I was born a long, long time ago. I don't remember it. It was so long. And then in high school, I was playing football, not very well, but I was on the team. And I would think I was either a defensive back or defensive end during this drill, a goal line drill, and it was a pass, and the guy I had responsibility for went out for a pass. The ball was thrown to him. He jumped. I jumped. He jumped a lot higher than I did. I landed. He landed right on my leg, and I was sitting in the end zone looking at the bottom of my foot, staring me in the face. During my rehab process, I was sent actually to work with Glenn Johnson, who is the head football athletic trainer for the Mountaineers, now an orthopedic surgeon. And just being in that environment triggered something in me. Mm-hmm. And then after I received my bachelor's, as you mentioned, went to Ohio University to get my master's. They asked me if, for some reason or other, they asked me if I wanted to stick around and work as a clinician, got my doctorate during that time. And then, as you mentioned, it went to Boston to serve as a program director at Northeastern. Was there for 16 years, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
Took a U-turn, came back to Athens.
Now, over the time of your career, clinically, how long did you practice as a clinical athletic trainer versus, you know, before you got into academia?
1 year of free, nothing but clinical work, and then 5 years doing both.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to Boston, other than a few remnants from Coco of things that he used to do, pretty much have been totally on the nerd side.
Now, do you ever miss being a clinical athletic trainer, or are you just so far removed from it that all you know is really the academia side?
Yes, I miss it. I do try to stay connected with it. Like, I'll go to our facilities here, help out work, or just talk to some of our clinical staff who occasionally ask input on things. So, I'm not in an ivory tower. I'm still Chad, and I try to stay as connected as I can as possible.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Other people that... tell you that I'm as disconnected as possible.
Well, I can tell you, this was 30 years ago, but when we were learning, to become athletic trainers, and, you know, had you, the greatest thing is we had you not only as a program director, but you taught our classes, you taught our therapeutic exercise, you taught our modalities class, you taught our rehab, I believe, class, maybe an organ ad too, or maybe Peg Stacy did that for us, but you were in that, you're still using that clinical side of you to teach us, which was great. And I go back to the day that we were in class and we were learning about the lower extremity and the foot, and you stood up on the desk and took your foot out of your shoe and smashed your foot on the ground. And you said, "This is Pez playing a smash," and smashed your foot down on the table. And everybody just looking at each other like, "What the heck just happened?" And it was one of those things where I said it was the shock and awe of education that a lot of us remembered those type of things. And the other one was a bank card lesion, because you were talking about sticking your ATM card in the bank machine and the bank card got spit out and hit you in the armpit. So, you know, those things stuck with me, and we still laugh about those when I talk to classmates, when we kind of reminisce about our education that you had provided for us, which was fantastic.
Well, if it makes you feel any better at all, my teaching style in person has not changed in the least bit.
That's perfect. I mean, the great thing about education, and I was always, I mean, you probably don't remember, I wasn't the greatest student. I did enough, I think, and learned a lot. It took me a little bit longer to learn, but I was able to do it. And for me, it was the visual learning that I did the best with. So for me, seeing things in action really helped me. And now, being a clinical instructor for the past, 28, 29 years, I myself, try to do a lot more visual learning with the students, because I feel like they grasp that more.
Have you seen the Netflix series Wednesday?
No.
There's a really famous scene in there where Wednesday Adams, played by Jenna Ortega, does a dance to a song, Goo Goo Muck by The Cramp.
Okay.
It's from our generation. And it's one of the, and I did, had the music going in and everything to show them the difference between an open and closed kinetic chain. And every student, well, pairs of students in their class on their own recorded videos of them doing it. It was quite entertaining.
Good. I have to tell you, it's like I still reference those days. And, it was a really good time in my life to learn. And I thank you for that. And my other professors were fantastic, too. And, I went on to get, two master's degrees outside of my undergraduate. And it just made me a better student. The way that you taught us and the way that we learned was fantastic. And, I always talk to students about trying to make sure that they get the best out of their, academic education, but clinically as well, they really need to make sure that they're.
I apologize for the cat. That's
fine. Mine are all downstairs. They might come up here soon.
That cat has one eye and is 80% blind in the one eye she has. So her name is Eileen. That's one eye.
I wouldn't, you know, that is actually pretty funny because, you know, for you, I know that there's always some comedy behind. You try to get as much out of it as you can, which is great. Now, as we look at the profession of athletic training, you know, we've seen it go from bachelor's degree to master's degree. You know, when I came out, we all had bachelor's degrees, and a lot of the jobs were master's preferred. A lot of us end up getting kind of our foot in the door and went back and got a master's degree to kind of help keep us, you know, employed or at the top of the list of employment. Now, when we look at, you know, kind of fast forward here, DAT, what are the benefits for somebody going back and getting their doctorate in athletic training if they've been practicing or even not, just thinking them going through school, getting their master's and then on towards DAT?
In our DAT program, and I'm sure this applies to most, we have some students who go straight from their master's and start a DAT. I have other students. Well, one student who just graduated, and you want to feel old. My first class I ever taught at Ohio University, he was a student then.
Wow.
And now that the twilight of my career, he just graduated from our DAT program.
Wow, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Let's take a couple steps back with your question. And by the way, I didn't read the questions in advance because I'm better spontaneous than knowing what's coming.
I know that. I thought about not sending anything to you, and I said, you know, maybe I'll send something to him.
We're totally wrong. Back when you graduated, the reason why many positions required a master's degree had nothing to do with qualifications. Mm-hmm. They never said a master's degree in athletic training or rehabilitation. It was just a way to filter out the number of candidates that, especially colleges and universities,
okay,
would get. And that continued till 5 years ago or so when we started in earnest transitioning to the professional master's degree, which I do think yields better prepared students to enter the profession. But now that we're at the professional master's degrees, you know, any post-professional education is going to be a residency or a DAT. So we're trying to fill that void.
Okay.
And I don't know if yeah, I guess you do. You message me on LinkedIn, so you must be on it. Nothing slips past me. We've been doing those postings on job salaries and things like that, and
yep.
It happened today that we now have enough data that we can confidently say years of experience, there's a significant difference between most of those, and then degree level, there's also a statistically significant difference. So DAT should lead to higher pay as well. Just like somebody, an AT that had a bachelor's and got a master's would expect higher pay.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there was, you know, we were talking about this. I was talking to another colleague about how PT went into their, you know, their DPT programs. And a lot of people were kind of on the fence for that are in the physical therapy profession. And their thought was that, you know, we're letting a lot more, or I should say, some smarter, not to offend any PTs out there, but smarter people into the program, but they may not be as clinically strong as some others. So I don't really know if that's like a good assessment of it. When a lot of PTs that I've grown up with or known have gone through a bachelor's and or a master's program, and just the extension of their professional degree, if that really made better clinicians or not.
Well, the way that they've structured their DPT, where you have multiple off-campus rotations, let's do a good job of clinically preparing them. One of the big arguments against athletic training going to the master's level is it's obviously an additional expense. Mm-hmm. And if it were a three-year master's program, it may as well have been an entry-level doctorate, but that would have jacked up the price to really make it prohibitive.
Yeah, I was talking to a dean at Babson College several months ago on the return on investment on education, and he was kind of struggling on the thought process of the return on investment, only because he said the cost of education just keeps going up and up and up and up and up. And he said some of these jobs, he said, even with his kids, he's like, you know, my kids are now in college and then trying to figure out what they're going to do. And are they going to be able to, if they have to afford college themselves and pay for it, what's the rate of or the return on investment? And I was, you know, you have to sit back and think where some of these kids can go into programs that aren't professional related programs and start working and then do very well in a career in the trades versus going to college. You know, I think there's probably an argument there on where do universities and colleges go to try to make it more affordable. But that being said, I was talking to Chris Haverty, who was the director over at LaSalle College for athletic training and the program lead, who now she's actually has a different role there. And she made a great point. She said, listen, it's not about the return on investment for your education is for your whole life. It's not for two or three years down the road. So say it does cost you $100,000 to go to school. You're going to make tenfold or more than that over your career. So you have to look at it as a career, basically. So I think the way some people look at it is a little bit more skewed. And you got to think of it as a career, not as a job when you're getting out of college.
Right. But to counter that, when we look at the institutional level, first of all, college education is far more expensive than it should be. You know, they keep jacking up tuition, et cetera, except for our DAT program.
That's good.
But it doesn't come back to the people that are actually delivering the content.
Okay.
I forget which one, but there was a dean at Northeastern, and this kind of sent up one of the first red flags, who said that when a year of college tuition is more than somebody will make in the first year of their job, that program's not viable. And I think maybe we're seeing that to a degree, and the profession did a horrible job of planning for the transition to the master's. It was too much of a free-for-all. We had, 7 years where a student could choose both. So those master's programs that started tended not to have well-enrolled programs.
Yeah.
But we are starting to see an uptick in enrollments nationally. So hopefully this job situation will begin to settle down in a couple of years.
It would be nice if it does. I think there's definitely still a need for us in the profession that are still, you know, providing the care that we provide every day. And I think a lot of us still love doing what we do, no matter what. I mean, obviously it's nice to make money, but we all didn't get in it for the money. We got in it for the love of what we do and what we want to be doing to help people. So to give your program a little plug, can you tell the listeners about why Ohio University is the place to be?
For the DAT?
For the DAT program, or, you know, even for the master's. Why should they come and hang out with you and learn from you?
Well, hopefully they would come for the other faculty. With the DAT, it is 100% online. It's only 42 credits, and out of state, the tuition total cost is $547 per credit hour.
That's pretty good.
Yeah, so you can get your whole DAT degree for one quarter's.
What I paid for my daughter's undergraduate education.
Yeah.
Now she's in grad school, and I'm like, I got to go work seven more jobs.
Yeah, and we did absolutely keep cost and flexibility in mind when we developed it, knowing that athletic trainers have insane lifestyles, and it would be very impractical to say, okay, we're going to meet Wednesday nights at 8. Your student in Japan, Wednesday night at 8.
It's not Wednesday night at 8.
Yeah. So tried to be a bit user-friendly there.
Yeah. Now, how many students per year do you admit? Is there a cap on what you guys have for cohort?
We started in 2021. Our first class, we put a hard cap of 5 students.
Yeah,
just to pilot test the program. And we were also teaching out our old post-professional masters.
Mm-hmm.
So we had 5 the first year, kept the second year low with, I think, 7 or 8. And this fall, we should have close to 60 total.
Okay. That's pretty good. That's pretty successful.
Yeah.
What are some of the courses that they're, so thinking back to my undergraduate education, and on top of the master's that you guys have, what are the other core curriculum classes that they're taking in the program?
One of them, to me, the most fascinating, and it's fascinating because it's so far above my head, is a course called Neuromechanics that, you know, examines the concept of neuroplasticity.
Mm-hmm.
And basically how to integrate, you know, retraining the brain into the rehab process. I teach a course on sports epidemiology. Of course, that one is absolutely terrible. Dr. Janet Simon, who is absolutely brilliant, teaches patient-oriented outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Class that I think, you know, people ask, well, how come strength and conditioning coaches get paid more than athletic trainers? And one of the base reasons is that strength and conditioning coaches can quantify what they've done.
You're correct.
I've decreased the average time in the 40 by 9/10 of a second.
Mm-hmm.
They can bench press 20%. Athletic trainers don't really have that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, institutes do. A.T. Still's research network looks at some of this, but you know, it's something that athletic trainers really need to start doing a better job.
You know, it's interesting you say that because we talk about quality of care and then patient predicting outcomes or patient predictors and outcome related recovery. And, you know, in the physical therapy world, so, you know, aside of me still working in athletic training, I'm a clinical director for a pretty big national PT practice. And it's the company that I worked for previously was sports and physical therapy, and they were acquired by ATI Physical Therapy. So ATI has one of the largest patient data outcomes in the country, or really is the big company in the country. I think it's about 2.5 million data outcome surveys that they have right now in the registry. So when they want to look at how a patient's improving and getting better, they look at what's the return on the patient, how are they getting better, where are they? And I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. AT has to do that. I mean, I've always taken or really recorded all of my data from my athletes on an EMR, and I can spit out the return for them, what their return rate was, what the average, data loss of them being on the field, like how long did it take them to recover. So I think, you know, those are some of the things, like you said, having that as a course is pretty fantastic, because unless you were exposed to it or learned how to do it yourself, you didn't have it in undergrad or even in a master's level. So I think it's the definitely the next level.
Just one more thing about what we're talking about, the DAT program. You can get a clinical informatics certificate.
Mm-hmm.
So that teaches people to take the data that they have and then present it in a way that even I can understand.
Yeah.
In a graphic visual nature, and people find that very useful too.
Which is good. I mean, I was thinking, you know, 3 or 4 years, probably 4 years ago now, me forward thinking, do I need more education? Where am I going to go in 10 years if I decide to leave athletic training, retire from it? What am I going to do? And I end up getting my second master's was in applied sports science analytics.
And oh, neat.
I became like a numbers nerd. So for me, that really sparked my interest in my big thing, sleep data. So I know for a fact, my research was really based on, if you don't get the sleep, your rate of return or recovery is a lot slower. Your cognitive function is a lot worse. Statistically speaking, it is. But we know if we can control that one thing we can control with somebody, we have a better chance of seeing other things change in their recovery. So for me, that's what I really focused on. And when I talk to athletes now, the first thing I ask them is like, how much sleep do you get at night? Because they're burning at both ends. They're up late trying to, get ahead of their homework. They're up late because they're doing, or not getting home till late, eating late, and they're really minimizing the amount of time that they're recovering. And, we want to really do some more research on the injury rate if we're monitoring them more closely with a wearable device. So for me, that right there shows that I can bring more value as an athletic trainer to be able to show this. And I think, like you said, if you have something like that in a program, it's going to be positive for that individual that's, moving on their educational career.
We need more people like you. Yeah.
Is it because I'm that good looking, or is it because I just want to keep educating myself? What?
Wait a second. No, it's not that.
I think we have to think of, and I like I said at the beginning, I feel like education, I may have not said it. We may have talked about it before I started recording. I feel like education is never wasted, right? I feel like there's always an opportunity for you to get better at what you're doing. And if you're humbled by what you're doing because you don't know everything, you want to learn more and you want to get better at what you do, at your craft. And I tell staff members or colleagues when we're talking about patient care, I feel offended if I've evaluated an athlete and they don't come in to see me. I kind of feel offended they didn't come back and see me because we did find something wrong with them. And I feel like if we're educating ourselves all the time and getting better at what we do, we're making a difference, for us as professionals, but also for the profession itself, right? If we're looking that if we're doing that to make ourselves better. So, I wish more of us stayed, you talked about this before, like just stayed in the profession. And I understand the whys, why people got out for whatever reason,
going to that most trusted news source of all, Reddit. if you hop in the physical therapy section, they have the same complaints we do.
Yeah.
If you had to do it again, would you choose this? All the naysayers would say absolutely not. Think about it. You ask a 17-year-old kid, what do they want to do for the rest of their life?
Yeah,
it doesn't work that way.
No. I'll give you a little example here. We're talking about, what kids at 17 want to do. So our daughter now is going to be 24. She went and applied her undergraduate degree from marine biology. She wanted to be a shark researcher because I exposed her to scuba diving at like 14 and she loves the ocean. So she wanted to be a researcher. I said, okay. So she applied to school. She did the whole thing, got in. She went to URI, started out as a marine biologist. One semester, she called us. She goes, I'm switching out of my major. I'm like, what are you talking about? And she's like, I really sat down and thought about this. I don't want to sit behind a lab microscope for the rest of my life. And I don't know if I'm going to be wanting to sit on a boat for the rest of my life either. And she also came up with, well, what's the job market look like? Can I support myself? So right then she said, can I support myself? It like just changed my perspective, right? She took a class in speech, communicative disorders, and fell in love with it. So she really didn't fall too far from the tree because me being in the healthcare profession as an athletic trainer, my wife's a nurse, she wanted to become a speech pathologist. So, and she's also fluent in French, so she double majored, which is good because that's a great combination for her. But then she got into graduate school for speech language pathology, and she wants to work with adults that have aphasia and had, you know, traumatic brain or stroke patients. So for me, that's like, she talks about the neuroplasticity, yeah, you know, which is pretty cool to see her talk about it. So it's fun to kind of see that evolution, you know, which is good. Can you believe I have a 24-year-old?
No, again, how did you get older?
But I still look 24, don't I?
No. You truly do.
I had a kid that my first year I started at Weston. So Weston, I started in 98, the fall of 98. He was a senior and I'm still friendly with him. We're friends. He's like 4 years younger than me. I was sitting talking to him about 5 years ago. He went to BU. He wrote at BU. So he had the chance to meet Larry and those guys when he got injured at BU. He went on to become, went to the Army, became a lieutenant, and then became an Army Ranger. And then he went and he finished first as an Army Ranger in his class, and then he got into selection for a group to be a Green Beret. So he just came and talked to some athletes on leadership and development for athletes. And, you know, for him, you know, we talked about like, how do you, you know, get better as an individual and how do you get better as a leader in what you're doing? And he went through this whole like just explanation on how you get there through being in the military, but how can you shape yourself as an athlete or as a student? So it was pretty interesting that we've been kind of in touch for, you know, 25, almost 30 years, but he was one of the first athletes I ever dealt with and we stayed in touch, which is pretty, pretty cool.
Yeah. They are your legacy.
Yeah.
And your daughter, of course.
Yeah. But the athletes, I think, and I speak about this frequently, even with the students that we have for clinical, if you do the right thing for somebody, they're always going to remember you and they're going to come back and, you know, ask you for that advice. Right. Which is good at some level, right? Depending if you give them good advice or bad advice.
I think that you were in the group of students where I would say, you know, you did a good job if somebody doesn't remember you.
Mm.
Yeah. Rather than, oh, Andrew, he screwed up my shoulder so bad I could never play again.
Yeah, yeah.
But then there's that interpersonal part where, yeah, these folks are people and they have, you know, their own trials and tribulations. So,
yeah. And I think the other thing that you mentioned that stuck with me too is that you said if you're in it for the thank yous, you're in the wrong profession because it's a thankless job. You go and you do what you do. If you do make a difference, somebody getting better or healing or getting back on the field is thanks enough. So I use that too with students because I feel like if you're in it to get thank yous every day, you're definitely in the wrong profession because sometimes that just isn't reality.
But we do get thank yous. And
we do.
Yeah, you know, before we started up, maybe it was in this, recorded part. I mentioned that I worked at a high school for a couple of years.
Yeah.
I mean, parents would, this is as rural of a high school as you can get. Dude, I know you haven't eaten today. Here's some food for you.
Yeah, which is good, which is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do appreciate what you're doing for their kids, yeah. 100%. And when I, the community that I'm in is a very affluent community, and it's almost like the Harvard of high schools, right? So you have these very smart kids, and the fear of going into that as a young professional was whether or not they were going to want to listen to what you had to say about their child if they were injured. And quite frankly, it was the complete opposite. They were like tickled pink that we were there to be able to help and take care of their child when they got injured, which is good. So,
well, and when I started at Northeastern, let me pull up my calculator here real quick. I was 27 years old.
Wow.
When I took over as a program director.
What year was that? Oh, 88.
Yeah.
Okay. And so I came in at 91.
So I would have been in my 30s then. Over the hill. But so you remember Jack Baines.
Yeah.
When I first met Jack Baines, Coco Kasabian introduced us. We were talking for about 15 minutes or so, and he goes, "So you're going to come to school here, huh?" Coco with Coco's infamous.
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because the same person I talked about earlier, like I said, he's 4 years younger than me, or 5 years younger than me. I got that job at 24. And back then, we were talking, like I said, we were talking about 4 or 5 years ago when we kind of reconnected. And he goes, "How old are you now?" And at that time, I was four. I just turned 50. I'm going to be 51. And I said, "I'm 46, Fran." He's like, "Fuck, I thought you were 50 when I met you." And then last night, he was doing this talk, and he looks over to me and he goes, "You know what? I've known you for a long time, and you look exactly the same." He's like, "I couldn't believe that when I first met you, I thought you were 50. And he's like, "You're only 5 years older than me." So the perception of people is pretty interesting, you know. So good stuff. Moving on, I think the one thing I'd like to just get a little perspective on, like what you think. And I remember talking about this a long time ago, like the profession being called athletic training. Everybody had this like, should it be athletic training? People don't know what it is. So we just change it to athletic therapy. Should it be sports medicine and athletic training? Like, what do we do? So obviously it hasn't changed. It's still athletic training, which a lot of us still talk about ourselves as being athletic trainers. And we explain if people don't know. Do you feel the profession gets the recognition that it deserves? And do you think the name of the profession is one of the reasons for the pitfalls that we've faced over the years of people thinking that we can't provide or don't know what we are doing as professionals? That's kind of a loaded question, I guess.
Oh, and no, we screwed up big time on multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
People tend to be literal. Athletic. Okay, sports, athletes, trainer. You got a dog trainer, you got a personal trainer. And you know, they think that we're coaches. And some of us, quite frankly, act like we're coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is really one of the big things that hinders us. And you can, you know, talk to parents, and they will quickly understand what your qualifications are.
Yeah.
But when we go to modify legislation, third-party reimbursement, I'm not saying it's a good thing or a bad thing, but when we talk to people that don't have the time to truly get to know us, that initial impression sticks with them.
Yes. You talked legislation, and I'm going to get a little, it's not really off topic, but into going another way. You know, sitting on the Board of Allied Health for the past, I think I've been on for 6 years, we've gone back and forth about language. And they finally, in the state of Massachusetts, we finally put this through legislation, and it was stamped and signed and sealed that, you know, we as athletic trainers have always had continuing education through the BOC that we have to maintain our licensure. Massachusetts is one of three or four states that didn't have it for OT or PT. That just was passed. The language going through that was like, talk about beating your head off the wall, trying to get people to understand what it should be saying. And then, you know, basically for AT, they added, and we have to have, you know, ethics and jurisprudence or law, which is easy. It, you know, but we've always done it in the amount of people that we get that write in correspondence monthly, if they can waive their CEs this year, if you get a chance to talk to Jamie, we look at this stuff every month and we're like, you can spend $250 and get a MedBridge license and take all the CEs you want. And I think people just don't understand how they all think it's got to be in person. They think it needs to be, you know, forward facing. They don't understand the context of it. And my response to a couple people that had come to us was, we want you to be, you know, we're trying to protect the public for one, that's our job. But then also you need to further your education to become better at your profession. That's what it's all about.
I'm going to ask you a question. And I hope you can turn your camera on your face. Show me one bit of evidence that continuing education changes the way people practice as a whole. Certainly there are individuals who said, oh, yeah, I'm going to use that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I would really like to see some type of evidence of how continuing education improves a person's practice.
Do you think that it's what they choose? Like you said, what they choose, I think. So if somebody's taking C's just to take CEs, I don't think that helps, right? I feel if you're taking something that interests you that can help with the practice to work with the people you're working with, say you want to learn more on, I don't know, PNF patterns for the shoulder, how to better practice. And that, I would say you don't want to do an online course. You want to do more of a didactic in-person, like clinical course, right? I think those are very good for people to get better at those or to gain another certification for that matter. I do agree. But I also think if you're trying to get better at something to improve your practice, I think it helps to some level.
So what you're describing are self-directed learners,
mm-hmm,
versus mandated learning.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
So if I say, okay, my manual therapy skills are horrible, I'm going to go take these classes to improve them, that will improve my practice.
Yes, yes, 100%.
Now, two weeks from now, be in New Orleans where I can choose what I want to go to. I might go hear some friends talk or go to the exhibit hall, maybe sit in a bar. Those people, I don't think people like me that would do that probably don't get the benefit from these meetings that they should.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That was my case is purely hypothetical.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I'm not going to see you at the meeting. I'm going to be over on vacation. We had planned a vacation. So I won't see you down there, unfortunately. But I'm sure we'll catch up at some point because we should meet in person. I think the last time I saw you was at an NATA meeting, and you might have been getting the green jacket.
Oh, that's been a long time ago.
I try to go. And my big thing with the NATA conference, in all conferences, and I'm thinking the way you are with education, I feel like when I go, it seems like it was the same. I don't want to say the same things year over year, but similar. And I feel like I'm listening to a lot of research. And I like the hands-on. If I can do the hands-on, I'm doing it. But I don't want to go to something just to get 35 CEUs or whatever they're giving just to show up. And I know they changed that with the EBP, for the EBPs. So they were able to do the evidence-based continuing ed. So at least you're learning something. But that was and I guess that falls back on me too. Like if that's the case, maybe I should teach something, right? Yeah. I should submit something and teach it.
You know, this would be really unpopular. But what if in December you had to take a 40-question exam covering each of the domains of practice of athletic trainers, and you have to remediate your lowest areas?
Okay.
That would be interesting. Yeah, it would not go over well, but that's what we do with students, right?
Yeah, we do. Yeah, because again, with being on the board or any board for that matter, for allied health boards, you're trying to protect the public from the person that's delinquent, right? So if they're doing something incorrectly and they're causing harm, you're trying to make sure that that doesn't happen, right? So I think if you look at it, and the other thing that's very interesting too, like us as a profession, you don't re-examine again ever, where orthopedic surgeons and other doctors have to do it every 10 years. So is that something that you think is... would that ever come to fruition in our profession or even in a PT practice?
I was on, just shortly after I got to Northeastern, I guess it was 1990, I was on the Board of Certification, and it was discussed then. And I'm sure that, like everything else, it ebbs and tides, but it would be an interesting venture.
Yeah. I think it would take a lot of work. We're not going to see it in our lifetime, I don't think.
Certainly not mine.
Yeah. Well, you're still younger than me, so it's...
Yeah, good point. But I live dangerously, you know, the tightrope walking and...
Yeah. I got a couple more questions for you, because I know you got some stuff to get to, right? So this one, I think, I felt like it was a pretty important one to ask you. Just because of our profession being coming up on 75 years old, or the NATA is 75 years old, I think, this year, right? Coming up on it. Where do you think we go in the next 25 years or 50? I mean, can we say 50 years? I mean, where is the profession heading? And are we set up to be the best that we can be?
No. I don't think it's a huge secret that the NATA appears to be in a world of hurt financially. The overall state of our national organization is going to influence what we are, not 25 years from now, it may be 5 years from now. I mean, if you want to go absolute worst case scenario, I say this and it scares the hell out of people. You have Dollar General and the dollar store.
Yeah.
The dollar store was going bankrupt. What happened? Dollar General bought them.
Yeah.
If our national organization is indeed going bankrupt, I'm not saying they are, but I've seen some of the data that's floating around out there. If we're in that much financial trouble and somebody tries to buy us out, that could be a really interesting change in our landscape.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting to think about. I never really thought about it in that way. My thought was more along the lines of, are we educating ourselves in the best way for us to be the first respond, not really responder, but the first go-to for the consumer? Is the consumer going to want to see us because of our professional ability to be able to treat them and treat them better than everybody else out there because of our education and our clinical skills?
There's no doubt that we are very qualified. We as a profession and as individuals within the profession need to do a better job. This goes back to what we talked to before with their name.
Yeah.
People need to understand what it is that we do and how well we do it.
Yeah. And do you think that falls back on the organization, or does it fall back on the, you know, the professionals within the organization, or is it a little bit of both?
It's absolutely both.
Yeah.
it would be nice if our national organization jumped on opportunities to educate the public. DeMar Hamlin was a great opportunity for us.
Yeah.
Horrible situation for him. Yeah. You know, there are things going on that it would be nice to see an official press release to help build that momentum. But ultimately, looking at salaries, NATA can, educate everybody that they want regarding salaries and why athletic trainers should be paid more. But it's going to be up to the individual not to take the crappy salaries.
Yeah.
And the really non-existent work-life balance and so on. So it's at least a two-pronged approach.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Well, to close out for today, I think the one thing I'd like to ask you is if you had a rising athletic training student or even a young high school student that came to you and wanted to get into the profession, what would be your message to them? Not, and you can't say run.
No, I was going to say come to you. My message is that athletic training in most, and certainly in colleges and universities and high schools, is chaos. You never know what's going to come through the door next. You never know what you're going to see next. And therein lies the beauty of our profession.
Yeah.
You have to be prepared for everything.
You do. Yeah. Well, listen, I thank you again for coming on tonight. It was great to reconnect with you. This gets the most views out of every single podcast that I've done. So, and I'm looking for any sponsors. If you know if anybody wants to throw some money at it,
how about ATI?
I know. Well, I actually just interviewed our CEO. She's she came from CVS Health, and she was the vice president of MinuteClinic. So her and I sat down and chatted. She's fantastic. So, like I said, I'm trying to hit a lot of the people that I know professionally that I think have a good story to tell. And if we can get the message out there, it'd be fantastic. And, it's just something I can talk for days. So for me, my wife wants me to shut up, but I think hopefully people like to hear what I have to say. So
what type of people are you looking for?
So anybody within the profession of healthcare. So if we have, physical therapy, athletic training, sports science, nutrition, even business professionals in the business space would be fantastic. Like, healthcare vertical type, anybody that you think might be interested.
Email me and I can give you some pretty interesting names, I think, of people to talk to.
That'd be fantastic. I really do appreciate it. All right, sir. Well, I'll let you get going. I appreciate the talk.
It's your game time.
Yeah, get after it. I'll talk to you later. Thanks, Chad.
All right. Have a good one.
See ya. Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Behind the Sports Medicine podcast, proudly sponsored by AJR Sports Science and Healthcare Consulting. At AJR, we are committed to offering a comprehensive range of exceptional services, including applied sports science analytics, healthcare and sports medicine consulting, and leadership and coaching development. To learn more about AJR, visit their website at ajrsportsscience.com. This is your host, Andrew Rizza. If you enjoyed today's episode, give us a like, comment, and share it on social media. Access all of our episodes on platforms such as Apple, Spotify, or your preferred podcast app. Stay updated by following us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or visiting our website at ajrsportsscience.podbean.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science for upcoming content. Thank you for tuning in and stay tuned for our next episode.